Well, this is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. For today's young people, the road to adulthood is a long one. Marriage and parenthood come later than they did just a few decades ago. Young people today spend more time in school, and they may find it more difficult to launch their careers. Our guest for this hour, psychologist Jeffrey Arnett, says that we are seeing the development of a new period in the life course, something that he calls emerging adulthood. In this hour of the show, we'll talk a little bit about these changes that we've seen, changes in the way that young people experience their late teens and their 20s. As I mentioned, this is the subject of a book that he has authored. The title is Emerging Adulthood, The Winding Road from the Late Teens Through the 20s, and it's published by the Oxford University Press, is available in paperback. He is here visiting the campus, his host here, the Pampered Chef Family Resiliency Program. We've had folks here on this program and also on the Afternoon Magazine that have come to the campus to talk as guests of this program. He'll be giving this talk on this subject, Is It Better to Grow Up Later? The New Stage of Emerging Adulthood. That's tonight at 7 o'clock, taking place in the Knight Auditorium at the Spurlock Museum. And I think anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome. He also is the author of this book. And if you're interested in the subject, you can take a look at that. And, of course, questions here are welcome, too. We would like to get people in on the conversation. And if you want to call in, you can do that, too, very easily by dialing the number 333-9455. And toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, we welcome people into the conversation. The only thing that we ask is that people just try to keep their comments brief so we can keep our show moving along. But, of course, anyone who is listening is welcome to call. Again, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Maybe I better mention one more thing, that our guest, Jeffrey Arnett, is research professor in the Department of Psychology at Clark University in Worcester, Mass. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you. We're glad to be here.
Just to talk a little bit about the dimensions here of the we're talking about, the trends that we are talking about here, what would you say are some of the, if you look at the experience of people in this age range, this sort of 18 to 25, and let's say go back, even we don't have to go back too far, we may go back to the 70s, 60s, say compare the life experiences of the, of those people in that age group with 18 to 25s today. What would you say were the major differences between the two groups in these two different times?
Well, there are a lot of things. I think the most obvious changes are the rise in the age of entering marriage and parenthood, and also the spread of higher education, wider participation in higher education. So if you go back just 40 years to the early 1960s, the typical age of marriage was just 21. Hard to believe now, but that was the average. That was the median. And most people had their first child a year later. So that meant a relatively short transition from adolescence to a stable young adulthood by the very early 20s. Now the most recent census figures have the typical age of marriage as 27 and a half for men and 26 for women. And that's relatively low, actually, among industrialized countries. If you look at Europe or industrialized countries in Asia like Japan and South Korea, it's even later. So that's one big change. And then there's the wider participation in higher education, especially among women. Since the 1960s, there's been a huge increase in their participation in higher education. And now actually you have more women than men who are attending college. That's a huge change in just 40, 50 years. So those things together have meant that people enter a stable young adulthood in terms of family commitments and a work trajectory, more like in their late 20s now or even their early 30s rather than their late teens or early 20s. That's why I say there's really a new life stage that's developed between adolescence and young adulthood. People used to go from adolescence to young adulthood by their early 20s. Now you have adolescence and then emerging adulthood from about 18 until sometime in the mid to late 20s, and then young adulthood in the late 20s or early 30s. Yeah.
Well, one of the questions that you pose and then answer in emerging adulthood is when you talk about that term and the need for the term, not only for a new term, but the fact that there is something here going on that is indeed new. You say, well, you know, what makes emerging adulthood different from adolescence? You know, why not call it late adolescence or early adulthood, or I'm sure one could come up with a number of things to call it. And what really is the difference between the idea of emerging adulthood and, let's say, late adolescence?
Okay. Well, I think there are a couple of key differences. When you think of adolescence, it's really associated with puberty. I mean, it begins when puberty begins. And we think of it as the time when you're going through these changes that result in physical and sexual maturity. That's not what emerging adults are doing. I mean, by the time you reach 18, almost everybody has finished that process. You're not, you know, you don't have the growth spurt, you don't have the pimples, you don't have the sudden changes in body shape that take place in the earlier part of adolescence. And another key thing is that adolescents are minors. I mean, they are dependent on their parents legally, and they almost all of them live at home. Almost all of them go to secondary school. And that's not true of emerging adults. Some of them do live at home. Some of them move back at home. But they're not minors legally. And an awful lot of them, in fact, the majority of them, do move out around age 18 or 19 and don't come back. So they're usually living on their own. And they're not in secondary school. Some of them are in college. About 60% of them get some kind of college or post-secondary education. But a lot of them don't. And there are all sorts of combinations of school and work that they follow after adolescence. So I don't think adolescence works to describe them.
There are, you know, we talked about some of the changes that we've seen, particularly that when it comes to how these people are living their lives. And maybe if we ask, well, what in the past have been major markers of adulthood? We'd say, well, probably things like getting married and becoming a parent, in addition to being self-supporting and when working for a living, all of those sorts of things. So those are changes, at least at delaying marriage and becoming a parent, that we've seen. And if you ask why, you said, well, you know, there are some reasons. People spend longer in school. Maybe it's harder to get going on your career. One very big change has been in options for women in terms of education and career. So all those things would help explain what's going on. And yet they seem not quite enough to explain really why it is we've now, I don't know how you want to explain, we've sort of extended this period between adolescence and adulthood, or that it's become more complicated for us to define, to say what it is we mean by being an adult. You need to dig a little bit deeper and say, well, besides those things that we've already talked about, why has this happened?
It is complicated. It's not just the increase in participation in higher education and the rise in the age of marriage and parenthood. It's also changes like the sexual revolution, the fact that 40, 50 years ago, there was a very strong taboo against premarital sex, and cohabitation was living in sin, and people didn't do it unless they were really on the fringes of society. It was really considered a wrong thing to do. And now all that has changed. I mean, the sexual revolution of the 60s and 70s really changed things in that respect. And now about 80% of people have their first sexual experiences by the time they're 17 or 18 years old. And two-thirds of Americans now cohabit before marriage. Parents often still aren't crazy about the idea. That's one of the interesting things in my research, even though it's now typical for cohabitation to take place before marriage. Parents often have very mixed feelings about it. But that doesn't stop their emerging adults from doing it in most cases. So they don't marry until their late 20s or early 30s, but most of them have some kind of cohabitation relationship before they enter marriage. And so they have some kind of partnership before marriage, even though it's a very unstable one. I also think a key part of it is the change in the role of women. Again, if you go back 50 years ago, what options were available to women? Not much. The only real legitimate social role for them was to become a wife and a mother. And so that's what virtually all of them did. And by their late teens, I think most of them felt a lot of pressure to find a man and get married by age 20 or 21. Because if you didn't, then you risked missing the boat. And by 25, you were an old maid and your boat had left the dock. But now, of course, all that has changed, and women can and do follow all sorts of different pathways. They're, as I said, the majority of American undergraduates now. They are half the students in medical schools, in law schools, in business schools. And so they feel like they have a lot more options than they did 50 years ago. And they're not in a hurry to get married the way their mothers or grandmothers may have been. They can find a lot of other things to do with their lives, and they want to. They want to have the opportunity to get the education, to start the career before they make those family commitments, even though most of them, and the men too, they still want to have a family life. But there's no reason to start that at 20 or 21 now. Why not wait until you're 25, 26, or for that matter, 32 or 33.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Jeffrey Arnett. He's a research professor in the Department of Psychology at Clark University and is the author of the book Emerging Adulthood, The Winding Road from the Late Teens Through the 20s, published by the Oxford University Press. He's also authored a textbook that deals with some of the same material. That's Adolescence and Emerging Adulthood, A Cultural Approach. But the book that I mentioned, Emerging Adulthood, really is one that's aimed at a more general audience. You don't have to be a professor of psychology if you're interested in the subject to read this book. Nor do you have to be a professor of psychology to attend his talk tonight on the campus at 7 o'clock, talking on this very subject in the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. So in the course of doing your research, you've sat down and you spent some time talking with a number of people who are in this age range to try to get some sense of what their experience is, what they're going through, how they think about it. It can be a time of real uncertainty in a sense that in my mind, I guess that's a little bit like adolescence in the sense that it's still a time when people are trying to figure out, okay, who am I? Where am I going? What do I want to get out of life? What do I want my life to be? As you talk with people who are in this age group, how do they feel about the fact that in their life there is that kind of uncertainty? And are they pretty much okay with that? Or does that make them uneasy?
I think it makes them uneasy, but it's also exciting. I think there's a lot of ambivalence in this age period. Because on the one hand, it's exhilarating to have the freedom as emerging adults that they didn't have as adolescents. Again, that's the difference between adolescence and emerging adulthood. In adolescence, you have to do the things adults tell you to do. You know, you have to go to school. You have to live at home with your parents, no matter how dysfunctional your parents are. You get to be 18, and that changes. You can choose whether to go to school or not. You can choose what job you're going to have. You can choose where you're going to live. And you get to make all the choices of daily life, what you're going to eat for dinner, you know, how you're going to spend your money. And so that's exciting, and they love that freedom. But along with it goes, first of all, the uncertainty of what you're going to be doing not just 10 years from now, but 1 year from now for many of them. And also the fact that they do have to deal with all the annoying things that adults have to do as part of life. Again, adolescents don't have to pay the electric bill and don't have to go grocery shopping and don't have to gas up the car. But emerging adults do have to do all those things. So they get the freedom of the age period, but also the responsibilities that go along with it. And they're not that crazy about the responsibilities. A lot of them talk nostalgically about how nice it was to be 14 or 15 and your parents did all those things for you.
Yeah. Well, certainly they do have those kind of responsibilities. They have to earn a living, and they got to pay the rent, and they have to pay their insurance, and they have to put gasoline in the car and all those sorts of things. But I think probably the knock on the folks of this generation is that somehow, even though they're taking on those kind of adult responsibilities, that somehow they're dodging what it means to be an adult. That is, that in a sense, they're still sort of delaying their move into adulthood. And I think that somehow adults and, you know, and perhaps their parents and their grandparents, you know, the people who are older, look at them and somehow think they should be more serious, maybe that they should be married or that they should be in a stable relationship. They should be thinking about having families. They should be, they should have a 401k and they should do all that kind of stuff. And that somehow they're dodging the real move into adulthood. And I think that that's kind of unfair, but I'm not going to understand how it is people see that. Do they think that? How do they react to that idea that that they're somehow putting off as long as they possibly can the actual move into adulthood?
Well, I'm glad you asked this because there are a lot of knocks on them. Yeah. And I've really been struck by that, how negatively they're viewed by adults who are older than them. And I've puzzled over it, and I can't say I fully understand it, but I think at least part of it is that adults are often applying to them the norms that existed when they were young. So these changes have taken place quickly, and you have a lot of people in their 50s, 60s, 70s at least, who got married quite young. You know, they were the ones getting married at 20, 21, 22 and getting the job that they had then for the next 30, 40 years and having a child and then another child and another child. And they see their children and grandchildren at the same age who are nowhere near those responsibilities. And they then conclude that there's something wrong with them because they're not entering these things. But I think that's a mistake. I think the world has changed. Mm-hmm. I think for one thing, it takes a lot longer to get the educational credentials and the skills to be able to get a good job in a modern workplace that's so information and technology oriented. But the other thing is, what exactly is the hurry? I mean, once you take on these adult commitments, you've got them for life, basically, especially if you have a child or more than one child. And once you commit to a real definite work path, you're likely to be in that for a long time too, maybe your whole life. So why not take this chance that you have from age 18 to 25 or 27 or 29 to do the things you will never be able to do again. You could never do before and you will never be able to do again. Why not take that opportunity to have an interesting job that you're not going to have later? Like, you know, if you want to be a musician, and maybe you're not going to be doing that when you're 40 or 50, but why not do it when you're 21? You're never going to be able to have that chance again. You're not going to be able to start doing that when you're 50. At least you better not. You'll have a lot of commentary on it from your wife and children and so on by then, or husband or whatever. Why not travel to some interesting place? Why not live in China teaching English for a year, or, you know, take a semester and go to live in Prague as my niece is this semester, who's a student at the University of Kentucky. Why not do those things now that you're never going to have the chance for again, and wait for the commitments of adulthood until you're ready for them and until you've done the things that you wanted to do with this unique period of emerging adulthood?
We have several callers here. We want to bring them into the conversation, and you can do that by joining us at 333-9455. That's the Champaign Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line, so if it would be long-distance call for you, use that number. We'll pay for the call, 800-222-9455. First caller up is in the community of Fisher, and this is line number one. Hello?
Yes.
Yeah.
Hi. Hey, I don't want to drag this down, but one of the things that I have noticed about our society is the drastic, destructive effects of divorce on how it affects children. And I'm really curious to hear what you see in this situation. It is epidemic across this nation, and it really affects children. And I'll hang up and listen to you.
All right.
Well, I'm glad you brought this up, and I have a section in my book on this. I was really struck by this in interviewing emerging adults, how intense their feelings were often about it, even when the divorce had taken place 10, 15, 20 years previously. Often the emotions were still really strong, and there was a lot of bitterness on their part toward one or both parents for what they went through in their parents' divorce. And, of course, not just the event of divorce, but years afterwards of parental squabbles over who pays for what and where the child should spend holidays and summer vacations, and just the years of acrimony that followed divorce are often part of their childhood, even if the divorce took place when they were young. And I was really struck by it. And one thing that goes along with that for many emerging adults is a real determination on their parts not to have their own children experience that. So the ones who have gone through divorce, they're really determined to have a good marriage themselves. And that's one of the reasons they wait to get married, is that they don't want to make the mistake their parents did. They don't want to put their own children through what they went through. And, of course, it's very touching and moving to listen to them, because I know statistically, as maybe you do too, that the risk of divorce is actually higher for children who grow up in a divorced family, not lower. So in spite of their determination, their risks are actually higher. But nevertheless, they're really determined at this age, before they get married, that's not going to happen to them. It's not going to happen to their kids.
So possibly having a number of partners before marriage, or living with somebody that sometimes gets criticized as again, sort of immature or dodging responsibility, or, you know, wanting to have the good stuff in the relationship without the tough stuff, that you'd seem to be finding that, in fact, these people are actually pretty serious about finding the right partner and are trying to be as sure, of course, you can't be sure, but trying to be as sure as they can before they actually sign on the dotted line that this is the right person, because they don't then want to go through that experience that they went through as children and maybe that they saw that their parents go through.
Yeah, they're very serious about it, but they have very high expectations for marriage too, maybe unrealistic expectations. I mean, everybody wants to find their soulmate today. That's the new ideal. And it's not just my research that has found this. It's also, for example, the National Marriage Project, which has done excellent research on how young people look at marriage. They find this too. Everybody wants to find their soulmate, and that's the ideal, this person who just fits you perfectly, and you're going to have this romantic relationship that's going to be sustained throughout life. And it's great, of course, if you can find it. But is that really a realistic standard for marriage? I think when people have that idea, when they expect so much out of it, a lot of people are going to be disappointed. And I think a lot of people are going to find, especially once they have children, that raising children is in constant conflict with that romantic ideal. It's in constant conflict with marital intimacy, because kids always need something. And it lasts for a long, long time, not just a few years, but a long time, 18 or 20 years at least. And when people expect there to be a lot of marital intimacy and then they have kids, I think often they're dismayed to find how incompatible those are. And I think that's why you have a lot of divorces, even though people go into it very determined not to get divorced.
We have another caller here, a couple of other callers. Next up is Urbana, line two.
Hi there.
Yes. Go ahead.
Hey. Yeah. So I got a question, and this is sort of speculation, but I was wondering if you could comment on it, which is that I would assume this concept of emerging adulthood was tied up with class, that you know, when we talk about more access to higher education, that would be more true among upper middle class people, that the marriage age would be higher for that group, that the ability to be not economically self-sufficient into your early 20s would be something you could do if you were in higher class. And so I'm just worried, I'm wondering, you know, how this idea plays across class lines and, you know, to what extent that factors in. So I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Good question.
That's an excellent question. I'm glad you brought it up because it comes up often when people respond to my research. I made a real point in my research of interviewing a lot of people who had not gone to college because I wanted to know about their experiences too. And I expected to find a lot of differences between them and those who had gone to college. And I did find some, although not as many as I expected. The ones who had not gone to college also wanted to find a soulmate in marriage. They also wanted to wait until their mid to late 20s, at least before making the commitments of adult life. And generally they did. And they also, I think, had very high and probably unrealistic expectations for work. In fact, the expectations for them are especially unrealistic because if you don't have that credential of a college education now, you really are likely to struggle in the workplace. Your chances of making a good middle class or above wage are really diminished compared to people who have college education. But nevertheless, almost without exception, they think at the age of 18 or 20 or 23 that they are going to be wildly successful economically as adults. They don't think the doors are closed to them. They think they can open a small business and succeed that way. And it looks easy from a distance. You know, it looks easy to open a restaurant or, as one guy was planning, open a tattoo parlor. One guy I interviewed, he was going to open a tattoo parlor. You can open a store like a bike shop or something like that. And everybody thinks that's pretty easy to do, but it's actually not. It's extremely difficult to do. The failure rate for those things is 80, 90% or more. But for all people at that age, it's an age of very high hopes, and they think that they're going to make it in spite of the obstacles that might exist for other people. They think that they're going to make it. I'm not saying there aren't any differences, and I want to make that clear. Again, their real prospects are lower. And, of course, their experience of those years from 18 to 22 or 23 or 24 are much different if they don't go to a residential university, say, like University of Illinois. Their experience of those years is different because they're in the workplace instead and they're struggling through a series of jobs, hoping to find something better, hoping to find something that will be fulfilling. But in terms of their expectations for life, I was surprised how similar they were to the ones who had gone to college.
Okay. Let's talk with someone on a cell phone in Champaign, line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
I'm just calling. I'm fascinated by this subject here. I just happened to tune in. I'm intrigued by two prongs of your study here, which seem pretty cogent and profound. One, from a personal standpoint, I really like the emphasis that you make, which I think is probably characteristic of very stable suburban families to say, the 20s are your time to do things you would not do. You're not going to be able to do a little bit later on once you may start making these pervasive and far-reaching choices. That's tremendous, and that's what we did in our home. We appreciate it. But I suspect that that's a pretty tight minority that has to do with bedroom community suburbia in the United States. Because in this whole area, there's a lot of other unrest and a lot of downstream issues for the whole culture that begin to foment and build out of this period in people's lives that affect an entire generation because of values where the baton is passed at this time, where the real life values of the parents actually take hold in the young. And I'm intrigued by that because, David, you had a guest on a while ago about the young, the Kikikomori in Japan, who resist going into adulthood and are hermits and who refuse to even face society. And their parents agree and help them not face it and do all kinds of artificial crazy things to keep that from happening. And here, we have much more latitude, and it seems like the moral deterioration, like the earlier caller said about divorce, and along with many other issues, is that the sorrow that we have now in a secular culture is much more public than the private sorrow of people trying to deal with the vicissitudes of life. And so since we've got technology and leisure and relaxed moral standards, the options seem endless, but the facing of reality is a lot more public and painful and amorphous in the way it's spread around through the generation. I guess this is just a whole mix of thoughts that come into my head, but I'm just interested in your reactions to them.
Okay, let me address a couple of things.
I'll just hang
up
and get off.
Great. Well, thanks for the call.
Let me address a couple of things that he mentioned. First of all, he alluded to his perception of a moral decline over the last 20 years. And then this is part of what you mentioned about this general perception that there's something wrong with them and they are worse than young people used to be and they're just generally no good. I certainly don't think that's true. If you look at pretty much every indicator of behavioral problems, they have all declined in the last 20 years in this age group. And that includes a wide range of things from criminal activity to substance use to abortion to unintended pregnancies of all kinds, births out of marriage. Across a wide range of things, those problems have diminished over the last 20 years. So if you consider those to be indicators of the moral health of society, you'll be pleased to know that those actually are getting better and not worse. But the other thing that I want to address that the caller mentioned was that it's really true that they have a lot of ambivalence about becoming adults. They are excited about it in some respects because it does mean you have more responsibility for your own life. You get to make more of your own decisions, and that's good. But on the other hand, adult life looks dreary to them in many ways. You know, when they look at our lives, basically, middle-aged people, they see it as kind of dull because everything has been decided, and you know where you are in life by the time you're middle-aged. And no matter, even if it's good, it looks like the end of things to them. It's the end of possibilities. It's the end of youthful dreams. So one of the reasons they wait until their late 20s or early 30s to make the commitments of adult life is that it really is the end. Emerging adulthood is the age of possibilities because you don't yet know how things are going to turn out. And that is a source of anxiety, but it's also exciting. It's also exhilarating to know that anything is still possible.
We're a little bit past our midpoint here. For the benefit of people who might have tuned in last, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 minutes, I better introduce again our guest, Jeffrey Arnett. He is research professor in the Department of Psychology at Clark University in Worcester, Mass. His primary interest as a scholar is in emerging adulthood, this age period, roughly speaking, from the late teens to the mid-20s. He's done a lot of research and writing on this subject, including a textbook, Adolescence and Emerging Adulthood, A Cultural Approach, and a book that's aimed at a little bit more of a general audience, Emerging Adulthood, The Winding Road from the Late Teens Through the 20s. That book is published by the Oxford University Press, and if you'd like to do some reading on the subject, you can look for that book. He's here visiting the campus, his host, the Pampered Chef Family Resiliency Program. He'll be giving a talk, Is It Better to Grow Up Later? The New Life Stage of Emerging Adulthood. That's tonight on the U of I campus, 7 o'clock in Knight Auditorium. That's at the Spurlock Museum. And anyone who's interested should stop by. Questions here are welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. One of the many things that you looked at in the book was the relationship between the people that we're talking about, the emerging adults, and their parents. And I'm interested in particularly how, if you can make some comparisons between the relationship that these people have with their parents and then, you know, going back, either, you know, the relationship their parents had with their parents or what, you know, how parent-child relationships might be changing or have changed.
Yeah, that's a fascinating question and a topic I really enjoyed learning about when I interviewed them. I would mention a couple of things. First of all, there's good news for parents here, which is that almost all of them get along better with their children when the children are in emerging adulthood than they did in adolescence. Mm-hmm. And it's true they're starting from a pretty low baseline because adolescence tends to be a time of high conflict and a lot of crossing of swords between parents and children. But for almost everybody, it gets better from adolescence to emerging adulthood. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that it's just easier to get along with somebody you don't see all the time. you know, most emerging adults do move out of the household, and they do get along better with their parents if they do move out. And that means they're not crossing paths every day. They're not having to have conflicts over who ate the last cupcake and who left their towel on the floor of the bathroom and so on. They get along well when they can manage the time they see each other. But it's more than that. Emerging adults really see their parents differently than adolescents do. Adolescents have a hard time seeing their parents as human. But emerging adults understand that their parents have feelings too. And they're much better at putting themselves in their parents' position and seeing life from their perspective. And that really makes them more gentle and more generous towards their parents. But what's going on here too is that parent-child relations generally have changed in the course of the last 40, 50 years. They're much less hierarchical now than they used to be. Parents don't want to be the big bad authority figure who is delivering stern lectures and then leaving the room, and then that's pretty much the end of their role. Parents want to be more like friends to their children, and they succeeded in that. I mean, the fruits of that really come in emerging adulthood, where they can really have a friend-like relationship. It's not just like a friendship, because some of that hierarchy will always be there. But it's more like a friendship than would have been possible for most parents and their children 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. They really talk about how nice it is to be able to regard their parents as friends and to be able to talk to them about a wide range of topics, just like they do with their friends.
And this might be more of a question directed to the parents, but I would expect, though, that still parents would have some concerns, would maybe wonder, will my son or daughter get married? Will I ever have grandkids? They might also worry about their future in terms of their career and, you know, given the fact that there are all sorts of uncertainties, they might worry about, you know, are they going to be okay, excuse me, when it comes around time for them to retire, you know, what's mm-hmm. going to be going on. Maybe their parents figured they're probably not going to be there at that point. But, you know, it is in the nature of parents that no matter how old you are and how old your children are, you're still going to be worrying about them.
That's true. And I'm a father of 9-year-old twins. And if there's one thing I've learned in the course of being a parent is that worrying is just part of the package. It goes along with the love, I guess. You love them, and so you worry about them, and I suppose that never ends. But I think the good news for parents is not only that their children are going to become nicer to them once they reach emerging adulthood, it's that just about everybody grows out of this by age 30. And I find that parents often are very relieved to hear about emerging adulthood and to hear that this is a typical life stage now. And so are emerging adults themselves. They're relieved too to hear that this is perfectly normal, that the majority of people in the United States and other countries, other industrialized countries, now go through this, and that it's a temporary period. It is a period of a lot of uncertainty and a lot of indecision, a lot of changes. But almost everybody finds their way to adult commitments by about age 30. So there's no sense in wringing your hands and gnashing your teeth over the fact that at age 23 your child has just quit his or her job and decided to move to California for a few years and just doesn't seem interested in making these grand commitments of adult life. Almost everybody does. And if they don't, there's nothing you can do about it anyway, honestly. You know, by the time they're 22, 23, 25, 27, they are going to make their own decisions. And you telling them what their decisions should be is not going to help. It's not going to have any influence on them. In fact, I find that the way they talk about it is they're less likely to make a decision if it's recommended by their parents by that age. They really want to make their own decisions, and you have to let go by the time they reach this period, because they're going to be very intent on doing these things for themselves. Yeah. If they want your advice, they will ask.
You know, one of the thing we talked a little bit earlier about, one of the trends that we're seeing, and that is people are delaying marriage. They're waiting longer to get married. And that maybe one of the reasons they might be doing that is that we have decoupled sex and marriage, and that people now in this age group have a lot more sexual freedom than going back some decades. And that's something that concerns people. You know, if you look at these people and you try to get at their level of sexual activities and how many partners they've had and so forth, is there really is how dramatic is the difference? And for those people who are concerned that somehow as a society we're sexually out of control, what happens when you take a look at these folks and really find out what it is that they're doing, or you know, how many people they're doing it with?
That's a really good question, and I just reviewed a terrific book on this that's going to come out next year. I better not say the title and author yet because it's not yet out. But I can tell you that it's not the sort of rampant 10-year sex party that is sometimes portrayed. Quite the contrary, in fact. The best way to increase the frequency of sex is to get married, actually. Married people have more sex than emerging adults do. And that comes as a surprise to people because, you know, the media portrayal of this age period is like it's this grand sex party. It's not. They're actually very diverse. In the course of the last year, in national surveys on their sexual behavior in the last year, you have the majority of them who have had one sex partner in the last year. That's the majority. You have a smaller group who's had more than one. And if it's more than one, it's usually two. You have a really small group that's had more than that. But then you have a substantial group who have had no sex partner at all. I mean, that's the thing about going through this age period where you have a lot of changes. You have a series of romantic and sexual partners, but you also have periods where you don't have a partner, where you're looking for a partner. You've ended a relationship. You have not yet started a new one. And you just have no partner for that time. So they're really diverse in their sexual behavior, and very few of them are living this life of just having one hookup after another. That's not what most of them want, men or women. There's the portrayal that men are always ready and willing, but that's not what most men want by the time they get to their 20s.
All right, let's talk with someone else here in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes, I had a question on, it'd be young adults, 20s to 30s, if you've done any, that had entered into any of your studies, as far as compared to people in their mid-50s, compared to young adults in their late 20s and 30s, have you found anything that might suggest that the young adults are less open to new ways of doing things and new ways of thinking as compared to, the older adults?
Well, that's a good question. And I've just been thinking the last few days that maybe the next thing I should do is study young adulthood, the period right. That comes after emerging adulthood, because there's not much research on them. We pick them up again when they reach middle age. There's actually some good research on middle age. But we don't know a whole lot about that period from age 30 to 45 or so. I can tell you this from having interviewed people through their 20s. By the end of the 20s, most people really do enter young adulthood, a stable young adulthood, where they've made commitments in both love and work. And what happens that's, I think, notable is that they make peace with their big dreams. In their early 20s, everybody wants to find their soulmate. Everybody believes that they're going to find this great job that's self-fulfilling and really is going to pay well. By the end of the 20s, people have made choices, and it may not be exactly what they wanted. You know, it may not be this soulmate ideal, but it's a person who loves you and whom you love and who you think you can get along with and whom you enjoy spending time with. And that's great, and that's enough for marriage. And in terms of work, it may not be this dream job that is just what you always wanted and it has great pay and you really look forward to going there every day, but it's a pretty good job and it's something you can live with. So I think by the end of the 20s, people make the choices, and it may not be ideal, but it's pretty good, and they make choices that they can be satisfied with.
Right. I've just found in my own narrow study that my own kids, I thought they would be more open to new things, you know, in their early adulthood. And I feel I'm more open to new ways of thinking than they are. But that's just us. That's just one little study.
Yeah, and people do vary in personality. Maybe your children just have a more conservative personality than you do, or maybe you're unusual for a middle-aged person. I think for emerging adults generally, there really is a lot of openness to new ideas and a lot of excitement about thinking for themselves. An earlier caller mentioned about how their moral views are in relation to their parents. And one thing that I've found is that they're really intent on deciding for themselves what to think about moral issues and what to think about religious issues. So that in their 20s, most of them have different ideas about those things than their parents did. They really feel an obligation to think through these issues for themselves rather than simply accepting their parents' beliefs.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
All right, thank you. You know, an earlier caller asked a question about how class might play into this, particularly how it is, what happens if you look at, say, upper middle class people for whom higher education is an option, and they do, and make some comparisons between, say, working class people who couldn't, you know, colleges wouldn't be something they could do. So they have to kind of think about a different career path. And that you said, yes, interestingly enough, the differences between them aren't as big as you might think. If you – and I know that you have also tried to look at what's going on with this period in life course in other countries to make some comparisons between American emerging adults and emerging adults elsewhere. Do you find the same kinds of patterns, the same kind of thing happening in other places?
Well, that, again, that's a very good question. To go back to the social class thing, I want to make sure that – I make it clear that I'm not saying there aren't social class differences.
Oh, sure.
There really are.
Yeah.
But I think people in the working class also have emerging adulthood, even though it's a different form of it. It's not the form of going to college for 4 years and then maybe going to grad school. It's the form of going to work right away. But I still think it's emerging adulthood because you still have this period of instability and exploration and big dreams from the late teens to at least the mid-20s, the way you do with people who go to college. It's just a different form of it, but they still do have some form of it. And in other countries, I think you have different forms of it too. I've done research in the last few years in Denmark and in Italy, and there's a really big difference between Northern Europe and Southern Europe, because in Northern Europe, they leave home at age 18 or 19, and they live independently. And unlike 40% of Americans, they don't come home again, the Danes and the Swedes and so on. They go out on their own. A lot of them, I was interested to find in Denmark, they have what they call a gap year between the time they leave secondary school and the time they either take on full-time work or they go to university. They have a gap year, which is just a year of pure play. So they might work at a crummy job for a while and save some money, and then they travel. They might go to somewhere in Europe and maybe work somewhere in Europe. They might travel to Asia. A lot of Northern Europeans now like to travel to Asia. They might work as an au pair in the UK or in the United States for a while. A lot of them do that. But they have this year of just pure play before they go to the university, if they go to university, or before they take on a full-time work path. In Southern Europe, it's a lot different. The economy is not nearly as good. The unemployment rate is higher, especially young people. And a lot of them live at home for the whole period of their 20s. There's not the same sort of cultural expectation that you're going to leave home by the time you're 18 or 19. In fact, there's a cultural expectation that you're going to stay at home until you get married. And for most of them, that doesn't happen until their late 20s or even their early 30s. And that's perfectly acceptable in Italian culture. It's not viewed as a problem. Okay, maybe if they stay home until past their early 30s is considered a problem. But for that period through the 20s, it's not considered a problem. The parents don't want their kids to move out. They get along very well, and it's considered entirely acceptable. Yeah. So again, you have different forms of emerging adulthood, but I think it's emerging adulthood in both cases because it's this period that is not adolescence and it's not the settled state of young adulthood. It's in between and involves instability, involves exploring different life options before making the commitments that structure adult life.
We're to the point here we have maybe about 1.5 minutes. So let me ask you this without giving you enough time really to give a very good answer. For the people that we're talking about as you talk with them, people who are in emerging adulthood, if you say to them, tell me what is your definition of being an adult? What does it mean to be an adult? What do they say?
Well, this is one of my favorite questions and one of the biggest surprises from my research. I thought people would say what the social scientists say, which is that adulthood is defined by a series of transition events. You move out of your parents' household, you finish your education, you get married, you become a parent. It turns out none of those things rank high with emerging adults themselves. They mention things that are all gradual transitions. So accept responsibility for your actions is number one. Make independent decisions is number two. And become financially independent is number three. Of course, a wide range of studies that dozens of people have done all over the United States, and in fact now all over the world, it's a remarkably consistent pattern. The transition events of finishing education, getting married, becoming a parent, just don't have salience to young people today as transitions to adulthood. Now it's these things that are internal, that are psychological, and that they measure themselves. They will decide when they're adults, thank you very much. They won't take your word for it. They won't let society tell them when they become an adult. They want to decide for themselves, and it's accepting responsibility for their actions and making their own decisions that are two most important criteria.
Yeah. If you would like to read more on this subject, you might look for a book that I've mentioned a couple of times here by our guest, Jeffrey Arnett. The book is Emerging Adulthood, The Winding Road from the Late Teens Through the 20s. The book is published by the Oxford University Press. He also will be giving a talk on the subject, Is It Better to Grow Up Later? The New Life Stage of Emerging Adulthood. This is sponsored by the Pampered Chef Family Resiliency Program on the campus. That's tonight, 7 o'clock in the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum. And anyone, I think, who was interested should just show up and hear what you have to say.
And could I just mention that my website, jeffreyarnett.com, has the first chapter of my book and a lot of articles that people can download for free if they're interested in more.
All right. Our guest, Jeffrey Arnett, is research professor in the Department of Psychology at Clark University, Worcester, Mass. Thanks very much.